case of the day is Draper against Martin. Mr. Curley.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, we're here today for a de novo review of the grant of summary judgment on these two consolidated cases. The sole issue before the court is whether the plaintiffs filed their complaints within a timely manner. In both of the decisions from the district court, the district judges, both Scott and Mills, found that the plaintiffs did not file in time because they had received notices of their layoffs more than 2 years before the filing of their lawsuits. These plaintiffs received notices, some late May, some by mid-June, and filed their cases June 30th, 2006, which coincided with the two-year anniversary of the effective date of the layoffs. Our argument here in the brief and here today is fairly straightforward. If we look at the cases cited in the appellee's brief, we note there's something very consistent throughout those cases. In those cases, the notices given to the employees, whether it be for termination or layoff or retirement, whatever the case may be, or denial of tenure, as in the Ricks case, what we saw was that, yes, there were clear, unequivocal, final notices given to those employees about what was going to occur and when it was going to occur. And the employers needed to do nothing else other than what they did. It was to give those notices to the employees. And they went through all of the procedural requirements they had to go through to get the job done. And I think the Ricks case is the textbook example where the school said to Mr. Ricks, you are denied tenure, you're not getting it. You get a one-year terminal contract, just like everybody else denied tenure, and that's the way it's going to go. Neither Ricks nor any of the employees in other cases cited had any reason to believe it wasn't going to happen. Now, let's compare that to this case. Here, what we know is that in order for these plaintiffs to be laid off, certain things had to be done. It wasn't just simply a matter of giving these folks notice that they're going to be laid off. Rather, because we're talking state government here, there had to be in place a reorganization plan. And that plan had to do certain things. Now, without getting into all the detail, I will say, for example, there had to be performance evaluations done of the employees. There had to be seniority had to be taken into account. Secretary Martin, or former Secretary Martin, he admitted, yes, there has to be a plan in place, and that plan would have had to be done, you know, by the end of April or early May of 2004. What we know now is it wasn't done. In fact, even general counsel for the IDOT said, you know, I can't even tell you there was a plan in place in June of 2004, by mid-June of 2004, which by then everybody had already received their layoff notices. One of the plaintiffs here, Brad Clearwater, he wrote a letter to Scott Dubit, one of the defendants who was a bureau chief of personnel, saying, would you please let me know if you got a layoff plan? I'd like to see it. Mr. Dubit replies by saying, we don't have one. So here, the employer, unlike the employers in the cases cited by the appellee, here the employer is confessing, we really didn't do this right. So, was there clear, unequivocal notice to these employees when they received their layoff letters in May or by mid-June that the plan, that the layoffs were going to go forward? The answer is no. How could they? How could any of these employees believe they've been given a clear, unequivocal notice that they're going to be laid off effective June 30, 2004? It simply couldn't be done. It was known that the IDOT didn't do what they were supposed to do. the Auditor General for the state of Illinois did a management and program audit, the results of which were made available in early 2006. And even in that audit, the Auditor General said, you know, IDOT was not able to give us documentation to support what they did back in 2004 to these people. It just wasn't there. So we know also from the record that in the testimony of many of the witnesses here, the people who were spearheading this layoff, Scott Dubit, Robert Millett, Mr. Stout, defendants here, Mr. Martin, they tried to claim throughout this case, well, we were just doing a material reorganization and we were identifying spots to eliminate, not people. This wasn't political. However, what we found in discovery that, in fact, they were targeting people, not positions. Stout had said in meetings, these are the people we want, and listed and named Mr. Clearwater and Ms. Draper by name. In the case of Ms. Libri, there was documentary evidence that they targeted her, and in fact, an email, I believe it was an email, said, the big dog wants more meat, in reference to Ms. Libri. So this was not a situation where positions were targeted. It was people. Now, we also know that this layoff plan was never really complete until after the layoffs were done. We had a guy by the name of Hank Priester. He got a letter that he was being laid off, yet after he gets his letter, Secretary Martin says, oh, now we need to find somebody to replace Mr. Priester, put somebody in his spot. This was a work in progress. There was no final plan. There was no unequivocal notice to these people that they were going to be laid off. And in fact, some people who received layoff notices and had been on a list were saved from the layoff. There were people who were rehired to work at the IDOT. So this layoff plan and these lists that continued to evolve and change, it was a work in progress. There was no finality to this. It was ongoing and it was changing. And the question becomes then, well, if the IDOT's not doing this correctly, and if they're not going to follow the rules, and they're not going to be coming up with the plan that they're supposed to come up with, then who should bear the burden of that? Certainly not the employees. They shouldn't have to assume that even though the layoff is not being done appropriately, that when they got these letters, the time accrued or started to accrue, started to run, and that they had 2 years from that time to sue. And I'd like to save the remainder of the time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Bob.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sunil Bawe, and I'm an assistant Illinois Attorney General here on behalf of the defendants, appellees. The district court's grants of summary judgment should be affirmed because the plaintiff's complaints were filed outside of the 2-year statute of limitations applicable to these Section 1983 lawsuits. Pursuant to Supreme Court authorities such as Delaware State College v. Riggs and Chardon v. Fernandez, the plaintiffs had 2 years from the date of receiving their termination notices within which to file their complaints. And this court has repeatedly held, as have all the circuit courts of appeals that have considered this issue, the plaintiff's receipt of unequivocal notice of a final, tentative, or non-tentative, and ultimate termination notices serves as the accrual date of an unlawful termination cause of action. There's no dispute in the record to show that the termination notices that the plaintiffs received were in any way failed to unequivocally notify them that they would be terminated. In fact, the termination notices explicitly made clear that their positions were targeted for abolishment because the department had the positions were targeted for abolishment due to material reorganization plans within the department. And the department made clear that there were no vacancies to offer any of the plaintiffs, and therefore it is with regret that the department informs the plaintiffs that they will be laid off effective close of business June 30th, 2004. I don't think it's possible to get any more clear than that. The plaintiffs were on clear notice that on June 30th, 2004, they would be laid off. And one of the things the plaintiff argued is that some employees received termination notices but continued to work. That's an incorrect statement of the record. Any employee that received a termination notice akin to the ones that the plaintiffs received were terminated from employment. Now, some employees may have been recalled back to work later, but as the Coomer Line case held, the potential for recall is insufficient to negate the finality or the non-tentativeness of a termination decision.
Counselor, how does it play out, though, with respect to the procedural due process claims that were brought? I understand your analysis with respect to your First Amendment claims, but we usually have followed, I believe, a different rule with respect to procedural due process claims accrue, have we not?
Well, I'm unfamiliar with a different rule being followed. In this case, we litigated this case on the two-year statute of limitations issue, and in fact the district court dismissed the procedural due process claim under the statute of limitations issue, and the plaintiffs have never
argued. The question here is, when did it accrue?
Right.
And you're arguing that the First Amendment claim accrued at the time they were given definitive notice of termination. But we do have cases like the McAuliffe case that say procedural due process claims terminate at the time of actual termination. And I wondered if you could speak to that.
You mean procedural due process claims accrue on the date of actual termination? Mm-hmm. I'm actually unfamiliar with those lines of cases. The plaintiff has not briefed that issue. We would argue that that issue is forfeited. If a procedural due process claim truly accrues on the effective date of termination and 2 years is the relevant statute of limitations, then they did file within those 2 years. Again, that issue was never litigated. That issue has not been briefed on appeal.
How about the state law claims? District court seemed to give those pretty short shrift. What is their status?
Those claims are all dismissed as well under the two-year statute of limitations analysis. Everything was dismissed under the two-year statute of limitations analysis. And again, that's all that we've litigated here on appeal.
She dismissed those on the federal law of accrual of the claims, right?
Correct.
They're state claims.
Correct. What the district court applied was a state statute of limitations, but then determined that the accrual date for the cause of actions accrues under federal law.
Even the state claims?
That's a question I honestly don't have an answer to. I've not prepared that answer. I could provide you.
They simply haven't argued.
They haven't argued anything like that. Yeah, everything that they've argued is simply that the termination notices do not provide a final, non-tentative, ultimate decision to terminate them. And I think that the termination notices, plain language, make it explicitly clear that this was a final decision to terminate.
Well, it doesn't make any difference. It says laid off pursuant to Article 10, Section 2, in one of them. That was Mr. Neuschpein. Mr. Clearwater just says laid off, effective, close of business. Is a layoff the same as a termination?
I think so. I don't think that there's any reasonable way to read the words laid off other than meaning that you'll be terminated. I think that's a pretty common understanding of what the words laid off mean. I don't think that gives the plaintiffs any objective basis to believe that they wouldn't be terminated. When you tell someone that you're laid off, you're basically telling them that you're fired, your job is over, that you'll be terminated from employment. If there are no other questions, we do respectfully request that the judgments of the district courts be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Curley?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, counsel. There is a difference between layoff and termination, particularly in state government, because we have to keep in mind some of these employees were union, some were not. They were merit comp employees, but in either event, one of the differences, and it's a very big one in this case, is that when there's going to be a layoff, you are limited to doing it for three reasons. There's lack of work, material reorganization, lack of funds. And if the agency has concluded that one or more of those three reasons exist, it has to be clearly outlined, defined, and set forth in a layoff plan.
Why does that affect the time to sue? And I understand that it affects your claim that there a substantive error was made, but suit has to be timely before the court will decide whether an error was made.
That's absolutely. It does have to be timely. And the reason here it was timely is simply because these people knew, these plaintiffs knew, that the IDOTs, they hadn't followed the rules. They admitted they hadn't followed the rules, that they didn't do what they were supposed to do. So I think it's fair.
Of all employment discrimination claims, every time somebody brings an employment discrimination claim, he says some substantive error was made. I was discriminated against on account of my race or my speech or, you know, a violation of state rules. But that doesn't make the timeliness requirement go away.
There is still a timeliness requirement. There always is. The problem is, in the cases that we have traditionally seen before the courts, is that everything procedurally that was supposed to have been done to effect the discriminatory act was done. But here, you don't have that. They couldn't have possibly given unequivocal notice because they failed to do the things they had to do to give that notice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.
Thank you.